This is an interview with Claude Sitton, December 11th, 1973.
Claude, let me ask you this question. In B.O. Key's book, he said that the Negro remains a key to politics in the South, and this was in 1948. Do you think this is still true, and why? And how?
Certainly not to the extent that it was when he made that statement. Because the Southern whites are no longer so sensitive to Negro participation in politics. I think that thing will pick it up if you just put it down. They usually do. Whites are no longer so sensitive to black participation in politics. Now, Raleigh just elected a black male. And I don't really think his race, aside from its influence among black voters, where it certainly was a big factor, I don't think his race was that big a factor in the election. It was not discussed openly. It was, you know, discussed among individuals, but not publicly. No one brought it up. I'm sure it was a factor to some extent, but certainly not what it would have been 5 years ago. I think it's changed considerably in that respect. I don't mean the millennium is here, but I think that whites are far more ready than they once were to, you know, see the possibility of black officials and accept
it. A lot of people seem to think that the Raleigh race, Mayor's race, is one of the most significant that there's been in the South because of the relatively small black percentage of voters.
Well, I wouldn't say so because I don't think his opposition was that strong. I frankly was surprised that his opponent received the vote that he did in the first primary. And after all, his opponent was an employee of the Merchants Association, Raleigh Merchants Association. He was not an especially striking candidate. Whereas Leitner had experience in city government. People were more or less used to seeing him perform as a mayor pro tem, you know, performing some of the ceremonial functions that Bradshaw, his predecessor, couldn't get to. So I wouldn't see it as being in that sense all that significant. Although it certainly reflects the willingness on the part of white voters in Raleigh to vote for a black when he's clearly, in their view, the best man. You see, another thing about Williams, Leitner's opponent, Wesley Williams, is that Williams would have continued to serve as executive director of the Merchants Bureau. And I don't think this sat very well with a lot of people. And another factor is the influx of people we've had from the outside. I haven't seen a breakdown on this, but we have quite a few people here from the North and Midwest.
It's not really a typical Southern city either. The income pattern here is very high. It's a city that depends on government, universities, colleges, to a large extent. Number of people in the leadership group here who are from the North, from the Midwest, other areas. I think there are a number of complex factors that figure in this thing. I don't think you can single one out, you know. You can't say just because Leitner's black and this is a Southern city that that necessarily means, you know, that very much in terms of the South as a whole. But I think it does reflect the general feeling among Southern whites that they are ready to see the black advance.
Does it also reflect that here was a case, though, in which color became very secondary to a very definite
part? Oh, absolutely, absolutely. All right.
In BOP's book, he also spoke of North Carolina as more or less being different from the rest of the South, more progressive and better on race relations. Just generally more progressive and much more progressive mode.
Well, my reply to that would be two questions. How do you square that with the fact that George Wallace carried this state against Terry Sanford, you know, a former governor, native son, and that this state also is the state that sent Jesse Helms to the Senate?
You've asked the second part of my question. Has North Carolina changed? Did Key perceive it wrong? Or did North Carolina
I think there was a flaw in Key's perception. I think North Carolina has been blessed with good luck up until recently when it came to the business of choosing governors and representatives into Congress. I think North Carolina's, I say good luck, I'm speaking now from an opinion, from a feeling that it's better to have liberal Democrats up there or moderate Democrats in these offices than to have strong conservatives or reactionaries, which I consider Helms. But I think Helms, for example, and Vinegar Ben Mizell represent a quite substantial segment of public opinion in this state. I can't explain why they haven't, that type hasn't won office before, other than the luck to which I referred. But you take North Carolina from Durham to the coast, leaving out Raleigh, which is atypical, and you find it largely rural, quite conservative in many respects, not too different from South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and even parts of Mississippi.
You agree with some of the analysts who think that the 1972 election was one of the most significant in the state's history, at least in this century. That what you saw there were some basic changes, and things are not going to go back to normal in 74 and 76.
Gee, I don't know. What is normal?
Well, the argument is that that was an abnormal situation, that 72 was an aberration. And, you know, once we get past Helms and Holzhauser, things are going to go back to normal. That is Democratic control. Statewide office.
Well, I think the state is still a Democratic state, but after all, you go back in history, North Carolina's always had about, what, one-third of its voters Republican? Then you had the nucleus of a Republican Party there, or a Republican streak. Add to that the growing disenchantment, not only in North Carolina, but elsewhere with parties generally. The tendency to, as the voter puts it, to vote for the man rather than for the party. Party ties certainly have been weakened very substantially in this state and elsewhere in the South. I think it represents that Holzhauser's election and the fact that Nixon carried the state just represents a continuation of a trend toward a two-party South. I think we're in an area where North Carolina, I mean, we're in a period when North Carolina probably is going to become a swing state. I think a lot of this shift grew out in part, the reaction of North Carolina whites against the more liberal racial part of practices of the Democratic Party nationally. But I think they're going to find out as we get on down the road that I don't really believe there's going to be that much difference between the two parties on race. And then, too, race is not going to have the effect, as I said in my reply to your earlier question, that it once had. So what you're going to have is that more and more North Carolinians are going to make their choices politically on the basis of their economic interest, rather than on race. You know, has been true in the past to a large extent. And that means that I think North Carolina will become more like the rest of the nation.
So 72 would not be atypical. You'd see more of a ticket splitting and more of a weakening of party ties in the future rather than less, if you're thinking about the next 10 years. That trend would accelerate and not decrease?
Well, I don't, for the foreseeable future, it seems that there will be a continued weakening of party ties. Whether when this trend will be reversed, I just don't know. You know, it depends on many factors. But right now, that's the direction in which we're headed.
Looking at the South, there are some people who even go so far to say the South is now Republican in presidential elections. There to stay for a long time. When do you feel that's true? And where do you see the South going naturally in politics? And what would be required to change it?
Well, take out that race factor, which is being done gradually, I think. Now, you know, we can always backslide on this question too, as the whole country has in the past. But take out the racial factor. And let's say, and I think perhaps it's true, that the economic factor will become most important. And if that's the case, you look at the South and you find the South to be the poorest region of the country. Therefore, I should think that the South would come to see that it has more to gain from the national policies of the Democratic Party if those policies continue to reflect the same kind of positions that the Democratic Party's taken in the past, then I think the South will continue to be Democratic, not as strongly Democratic as it has been, no. But maybe 60-40 Democratic in its registered vote.
You mentioned the South is different economically than the rest of the country. You know, this book is premised on several things. One is that the South as a region is different than the rest of the country.
Because of its history?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to ask you, if you take out race,
yeah,
what distinguishes the South in terms of other variables from the other regions of the country?
Economic disparity. Look at the
per capita
in terms of per capita income, right.
That is the basic difference?
That and its history.
The two are connected, aren't they? And race being the third leg of the stool.
Well, yeah, race has always been the glue that sort of held the thing together as far as the Democratic Party was concerned.
If you take that glue out, that is the racial situation,
right,
then you're down to economics.
Right.
And then you foresee, if that's the case, the Democratic Party has always at least been the spokesman for poor.
Right.
Therefore, in terms of the economic self-interest of the South, they move back into the Democratic Party after this reflirtation, in a sense, at
right,
presidential level with
right,
the Republican Party.
Right, but never again as strongly as they have been, as strongly Democratic as they've been in the past.
Now you see the Helms brand of Republicanism sort of a passing influence?
Yeah, I don't think, I don't even think Helms is a good Republican. I don't think Helms reflects the National Republican Party in his positions. I think he's a throwback.
No, but I'm talking about in North Carolina terms.
Rephrase that.
You see Helms is sort of a passing one-term phenomenon in North Carolina.
Not necessarily, because Helms has quite a bit of support, personal support that he's built up. You know, people vote for reasons of personality as well as reasons of party policy, probably more for reasons of personality in many cases. Many of them like Helms. I'm not sure that many of them have that good an understanding of what Helms stands for. Not only that, Helms is a very intelligent politician. Helms is already beginning to moderate his views somewhat to fit those of the public generally. Helms will change just like George Wallace has changed. The electorate will change. Where we come out, God knows. But I wouldn't say that Helms would necessarily be a one-term senator. I'd hope so, but I wouldn't predict it, no.
Where do you see the Democratic Party in North Carolina heading?
Well, I don't know. I think the Democratic Party is going through a very trying period now. I think there's a split here, a three-way split, I suppose. You've got, on one hand, the older Democrats represented by people like Thad Ewer and Edwin Gill and Dan Moore, that group, generally conservative, although nationally they've been loyal to the Democratic Party, but they've been fairly conservative in their policies here in the state. Then you've got some of the new moderate leaders, middle-of-the-road people like Skipper Bowles, I suppose Pat Taylor would, while he's more conservative than Bowles, would fit in there, Jim Hunt, people in that area in their 40s and 50s, and then you've got the younger Democrats who are far more liberal than either of those two groups. Now, and you've got the blacks. So, I don't know, you're developing here, you have here all of the different factions that make up the Democratic Party nationally. But what you lack here is any real party discipline as such. The Democratic Party in North Carolina until recently hasn't been a party. It's, everyone voted Democratic, but hell, you didn't see any party discipline in the legislature until just recently when the Republican governor came in. So, I don't know. It depends on what kind of leadership they can develop. Right now, it's sort of a leaderless mob.
Farrell described it as a bird that had no body but had many, many wings. No body and no head, just a lot of wings all flapping.
Mm-hmm.
So a very apt sort of description.
The period that we're writing about from 1948 to 1974, 25 years, as you think back over that time, you're covering Southern politics and so on, do any distinct periods appear or any distinct trends that you can really lay your fingers on? I'm thinking, for example, the civil rights. We've come up essentially three basic periods in that time by talking to John Lewis and Floyd McKissick and others. They see kind of a constitutional phase where there were a lot of court cases brought and so on, and then kind of a physical violence phase, now kind of a consolidation phase with more emphasis on economic goals. But do you see any other kinds of periods like that in the last 25 years, both in terms of politics as well as social and economic change?
Well, I think let me go back and amend my reference to the Democratic Party in North Carolina as a leaderless mob. And see if I can come up with a euphemism for that. An essentially leaderless organization, let's call it that. Okay? Quoted as calling leaderless mob. Politically, I think 1952 was a watershed. If you go back, I think you'll find that that Eisenhower carried into office with him a fairly sizable number, in relative terms, of Republican congressmen from the South. And that group has continued to grow since 1952. I can't think of any earlier period when, unless you get into the Al Smith Hoover election, you know, when you, let's see, no, well, that's back beyond the period you covered. But I see that as a watershed. Let's see if I can think of any others. Perhaps, you know, it started with the reaction against Truman in about 48, you know, with the Dixiecrat movement, and they attempted to give some legitimacy to the thing in 1952. Voters did, at least, by switching over and voting Republican instead of voting Dixiecratic as it was in 48, which really wasn't respectable, you know. This thing just continued to grow as, there were all sorts of factors. Television, the influx of people from other areas here, the race question probably was the single most important factor, I think. In an odd sort of way, it couldn't hurt the Republicans, because they had already suffered all the damage they could suffer from, you know, the old reference to black Republicans. The Democrats were the only ones who really could suffer from this, and they did, with Truman, advances that he brought about for blacks in the armed services and elsewhere. And you get into Stevenson candidacy, which wasn't that popular in the South, and then Kennedy and the Civil Rights Revolution, beginning in what, about 60, well, as far as Kennedy was concerned, I guess it began about 61 or 62. That's when he really got active. His administration did very little when it first went in office as far as civil rights was concerned, although the civil rights movement had already started rolling back in 1960 with the sit-ins. Of course, going back before that with school desegregation. But the Kennedy administration really made a commitment to civil rights, I'd say, about with Birmingham. The Birmingham riots marked the period when the Kennedy administration really got in and began to move.
How do you assess the impact of the Voting Rights Act?
The impact in what it did for black participation?
What it did for black participation and also the broader impact after that. It's the total political process. Or at which rate? I guess in effect, the impact of blacks after they got into political participation.
Well, I think it started all. I think it's been an extremely important had an extremely important effect. But I think at first it had a negative effect with whites, because I think many Southern whites were angered by it. but I think they soon got over this, say, period of 5-6 years. And we got into the kind of thing we have today where black participation in politics has become, certainly from as voters, participation of black voters has become the accepted thing. But you know, there was a period there when if a Democrat, say, in a primary, got a substantial turnout in black precincts in the first primary, then he was in trouble in the second primary. Because the fact that he drew the black vote certainly went against him. Right here, for example, I think only 2 years ago, Giles Coggins was defeated in a race for the state Senate because he drew a heavy black turnout in the first primary. So it cut both ways.
It also had the effect of increasing white participation.
In some areas. I don't recall just what the statistics show on that. But in some areas, that's true. Now, it's apparent whether it's real or not, I don't know. I don't know whether there were other factors, you know, that brought those whites out. But white participation has increased.
The rate of voter participation in the southern states since 1960 has increased, whereas
right.
the rest of the country has gone down.
Right.
But it's still a gap.
Right, is that, well, you know, did education play a factor there? Improving economic conditions play a role? I don't know. I suspect they did. I'm very leery of saying any one thing, you know, is responsible for development in politics. Aren't you?
Well, you think in that 25-year period, 1952 was really the watershed or the turning point. In terms of the Republican Party.
Yeah, that's where it really became apparent, because I think if you go back, you'll find a steady increase in Republicans being elected to office, starting with 1952.
How significant do you think the Cold War candidacy was insofar as Southern politics, from the standpoint of resulting in many, many voters who had never voted Republican, voting Republican for the first time?
I think it helped them to overcome that psychological block against voting Republican. And I think in the South it generated an awful lot of enthusiasm, you know, for Republicans generally. I suppose it had quite the reverse effect elsewhere, but not in the South. I think the Goldwater campaign was a plus for Southern Republicans.
The residue from that
is
enhanced Republicanism in the South.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what it also did. The Goldwater candidacy made some marked changes in the leadership of the Republican Party in the South. Because from Eisenhower, that 1952 Eisenhower campaign up to the Goldwater campaign, we had quite a few moderate Republicans in the leadership in the South. People like Elbert Tuttle, who was Chief Judge of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Trying to think of the name of the fellow down in Georgia there who was chairman of the party for so long. He's dead now. Bob, can't remember that name there. But all across the South, there were a number of moderate Republicans, but the Goldwater campaign changed all that. And it's never gone back. The exception in here in North Carolina, though, we've got, because we've got both the Goldwater branch of the party and the old Eisenhower branch of the party well represented in Helms and Holzhausen. That was the significance, I think, of the fight over the state party chairmanship here between Bennett and Rouse. Rouse represented the old Goldwater type, the Jim Gardner Jesse Helms Republicans, essentially turncoat Democrats who had gone over to the Republican Party largely because of the racial issue, or at least those who might see great opportunity in the Republican Party and were not prevented from going over by the misuse of the racial issue, which the Goldwater types engaged in. Whereas, on the other hand, we have Holzhauser and the old Lion Mountain Republicans, who I think are far more liberal than the Eastern Republicans in this state.
You said a half hour, and you just told me how much work you had.
End of interview with Claude Sutton.